Well, hello and welcome to Wild Vittles. Now, normally when I come to you on these podcasts, they're often cooking demonstrations, but you've noticed I've had a few interviews and I want to continue to do that because I find that there are these interesting and amazing people out there that are also operating in this space. And I think that they've got something, they have a voice, they have something to say, and I want to bring that to you. And today I am extremely fortunate to bring to you Chris Abigail. Now, Chris Abigail is a professional butcher, an educator of wild game butchering, an advocate for bringing people into hunting, and she's also educating folks on the art of wild game butchering. And if you aren't following her on Instagram, you're really missing out. She's one of my favorite accounts to kind of watch. I think she's authentic is the way that I would put it. I first met Chris at a Texas BHA conservation conversation at the Star Hill Ranch, and I want to kind of share a story about that. But you actually won one of our raffles, and I think you won a rifle, which was really cool, and you were so excited, which I just thought was really neat. But before we do that, let me give a chance for you to kind of introduce yourself, Chris. So who is Chris Abigail, and how did you become a butcher? And you know, I've heard your story on other podcasts, which is really why I wanted to talk to you, because you were a very unlikely candidate to become a wild game butcher. And not only have you become I would say a very skilled butcher, but now you're educating and you're advocating. How did you get there?
Oh man, it was a long way around to get to Texas. So I'm originally from El Salvador, and my family immigrated to Chicago when I was about a year and a half. And so I grew up in the middle of the Chicago city, and that's, you know, I always say that my exposure to nature was the lake and the local zoo that was also in the middle of the city. You know, I was not exposed really to any hunting, you know, occasional family road trips. You know, we drive through rural towns, and it was like a blink and you miss it kind of place. And which is funny because now I live in a blink and you miss it kind of place. Yeah, it's just wild. And so about 20 years ago, my parents bought some property down here in the hill country. And, you know, it was a family home. We would come and play at ranching, you know. And so when I was in Chicago, I was a professional photographer for about 10 years. And I specifically shot live performance, editorials, fashion. Like once again, very different from the background that we're here now, right? And what happened was that my photography career essentially ended overnight. I had my equipment was stolen, you know, and I had you build up 10 years of work, 10 years of gear. You know, it's you can't just go back to it overnight. And I really had to think about where I wanted my life to go. And my parents had retired down here to Texas, and it sort of felt like the perfect place to go and be able to breathe and figure things out. My friends called it my retirement. Nobody could quite believe that, you know, this raised native Chicagoan city girl was going to go live in rural Texas. And I still remember when my friend Danny drove down here and we looked around and she goes, "Oh, you are moving to the country." So it's definitely a 180 from the way that I had grown up and the life I knew. And there was a culture shock in a lot of ways, and trying to figure out where I fit in. The first year, I think I still spent it going to Austin. I spent it going to San Antonio, trying to figure out a city life here. And I thought about maybe I would go to culinary school. You know, I'd love to cook. We would have dinner parties in Chicago. My father's from a line of chefs. It seemed as sort of the next natural progression. And so I went to the Culinary Institute of America in San Antonio and got some really great life advice from a counselor there. And they said to me to go work in a restaurant for 6 months and see if that was really what I wanted to do, and then come back and give them their money, because it's a very expensive education. And so I said, okay. And so I did that for the 6 months, and it turned out that I do not like restaurant work. It was not the sort of pace that I was looking for in my life. And so I went looking, and I stumbled upon a Craigslist ad that said game processing. And I honestly had no idea what that meant. You know, for me, game was, you know, video games, sports, things like that. I never had known that word to be associated with wildlife in any
Because
way.
you hadn't had any experience with hunting up until this
Yeah, I
point
had
either,
had
right?
zero experience with hunting. For me, I didn't even know hunting was still a thing that people did. I didn't know, you know, I definitely came from a way of thinking that was biased against hunting, you know. You know, everything's from a lack of exposure.
We all have our own point of views, kind of from the perspective of the experiences we
Exactly.
have, and you wouldn't have had any
Exactly.
other experience. I
I
understand that.
had, yeah, I had had any other experience. And so, but what drew me was that it said learn knife skills. And so at that point, I was like, okay, that's something that like an aspiring chef should go learn. And I went, and I think within the first 10 minutes, they gave me a knife and a leg, and I stayed for about 7 years. You know, I stayed for about 7 years.
Very
I had the opportunity to be a chef over at a wedding ranch at the same time that I was starting out in butchery, and then I was also the pit master for a local barbecue place. So
Really?
I
Okay,
had,
I didn't realize that.
yeah, I had three very separate career paths that then I had to decide which one I could pursue. You know, I was getting married, and you know, my life was sort of changing, and I needed to
That
narrow
sounds
my
very
focus.
busy.
It was very busy, as you know, three jobs and all that, which I loved, but butchery really spoke to me because it was the most challenging. It was the most fun in the sense of I didn't know anything about it. You know, it kept me in a place of constant learning, and I love to learn. I'm a curious person by nature. But it was the Wild West, you know. I
That.
didn't really have a whole lot of instruction, you know, and as I don't know if your clients are aware, but commercial processors are not regulated, right? So you literally could butcher on the back of a pickup truck if it's a hunted animal, and no one's gonna come tell you any different. So, you know, so
It's not USDA, so there's
it's not USDA, right?
all those
So,
requirements don't apply.
right. And so it's great in theory, but in practice, you know, we can get to that. Then you have folks that say processors don't give them their meat, or we talk about batch processing, you know, so there's a lot of pros and cons to that approach. And so I really was, you know, self-taught. I had some mentors here and there of other butchers that would come to work, that taught me techniques. And but really it was just a matter of working, you know, over 1,000 animals a year. You know, you talk about repetition, and repetition and repetition. And so I stayed there for 7 years, and I started doing hunt camp, started getting more interested in, well, let me backtrack a little bit. So in 2020, right, it's almost like the before 2020 and the after 2020 of the
It is a
world, right?
major
Like there's,
milestone, yes.
yeah, it's a major milestone, I think, that we all share.
I agree.
And so by that point, I had been a butcher about 2 years, right? I don't even think that at that point I really understood butchery as an art and things like that. I was still pretty new at it. I was still really learning animal parts, you know. I was still learning the verbiage of everything else. But what I did know is that it it ignited a sense of purpose in me.
Wow.
Because it made me realize how truly disconnected we are from where our food comes from.
Right.
Right. And here I was working and learning this trade where I'm constantly reminded that this is an animal that is going to get turned into food. I could never separate myself from it. And it led me to start thinking about where our food comes from and how much I didn't know and how much the biases against hunting are not based in fact. You know, they're based in Bambi, where they're not hunters. There's poachers, right? There's a difference. And so I really became very passionate about learning about where my food came from. You know, it really started like kind of an individual movement within me. And I think as an artist by nature, as a storyteller by nature, that sort of bled over to my social media. And so I started sharing really as I was learning. You know, I was telling people, okay, this is where fajitas came from. But I had probably just learned that like 2 minutes prior.
I think that a lot of people kind of woke up to that during COVID. You know, when there were supply chain issues and you saw bare shelves, and all of a sudden something that we all took for granted, everybody said, no, where does this come from? Why is there an issue? And then I think people, a lot of people coming out of that wanted to be more self-reliant. I think we've got more people into hunting and fishing now because of COVID, which is causing some crowding issues in some places. But I think overall, it has made people more aware of exactly what you're saying. Where does our food come? What's our relationship to that? And what I appreciate about you, Chris, is how you put forward, you know, these truths. I think there are good ways and there are better ways to do these things. And the way that I see you do it is from the perspective of you have lived the experience of somebody that's completely unaware of hunting and somebody that's transitioned into it through education and experience. And now you have a different perspective and you share that. And I see you as a great advocate to, you know, because do I want everybody to be a hunter? No, because the woods would be too crowded and there's not enough, you know, game out there, right? But I want everybody to understand it. And I want people to understand, you know, my perspective, your perspective, that we're not evil people trying to hurt animals for our pleasure. It is a connection to nature. It is very primal, something that, you know, mankind has done throughout history and often for survival. But, you know, we are at a point now where, okay, do we need to do it? No, but we can still do it for really good reasons and in a very respectful manner, like the way you do it. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. You know, one of the things that became important to me during 2020 was to start kind of sharing that knowledge. You know, it became important to me that meat eaters reconnect, you know, especially folks in urban cities, you know. So I did a couple of pop-ups in Chicago where I did butchery demonstrations and then, you know, we ate the animal. And really, it was just to have these conversations, right? So let's just talk about stewardship of our planet. Let's talk about the stewardship of the food that we eat. And, you know, I always just feel that we're so disconnected from the food that we eat, you know, and then we talk about how we are what we eat. And if you don't know what you're eating, it's like you're disconnected from yourself, which in turn disconnects you from others, right? And so food is the one thing that we all need and is the one thing that we all have in common.
It is a common connection. Well said.
Yes. And all food requires some death, right? Like all food requires some death. And if we're unwilling to face that, we're going to not be able to deal with any sort of hard situations, right? So I always feel like my work is an invitation to be uncomfortable in a safe place.
Right.
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 And then to sit through that discomfort and realize what it says about your relationship to your food, what it says about your relationship to yourself, you know, to have these conversations. I have had, you know, vegetarians come to my events. I often even say that I have more in common with a vegetarian than I do, you know, with someone who is willfully ignorant of right. where their food comes from, right. doesn't want to know, doesn't care.
Yep.
Because I do believe that if you're eating meat commercially and, you know, we all participate in it, that you should be a steward of the animals that you eat. These animals, yep. they suffer, you know? And yep. so when you put that up against hunting from a humane, ethical standpoint, and you have one hunter out in the woods, you know, killing one animal to feed their family for 1 year, and that animal has allowed to live as close to a natural life as possible. Right. Everything's touched by man, you know, but
yep, yep.
has been allowed to thrive and live a life of relative freedom and free roam. It seems to me that that is more ethical in terms of if you're going to eat food, where you should source your meat from, right. as opposed to continuing to contribute to, you know, suffering sick animals that don't have that. They are not allowed to live their full natural lives. They're not allowed to have that experience.
Yep.
You know, yep. animals are emotional creatures, right. and it saddens me, right?
That it's a difficult topic. I mean, I come from an agricultural background, actually, and was a farmer and rancher before I kind of chose a different career. So I have pretty good awareness around that. And yeah. for those that are listening and maybe thinking, you know, what is Chris talking about? You know, the way that I would describe it is the confined feeding operations, you know, so yeah. where you've got high densities of animals, often chickens and pigs, with not much space around them. Cattle tend to be, you know, have a lot of space except for the final phase when they're put into feedlots. And, you know, there's a balance there because can we survive without some form of, you know, kind of commercial agriculture? Probably not with, you know, the billions of people that we have around the world. But I think it's a good voice to bring forward to make sure that we're doing it right, you know, mm-hmm. and as humanely as possible. And you know, I guess I'm working on the opposite end of the spectrum. One of my focuses is on hunters who, and I've seen these guys, the guys that went hunting with my dad, and they come to our place in Oklahoma where when they shot a deer, instead of celebration, it was a letdown. It was like, oh, what am I going to do with this now? And they have this misperception about, well, it's not good, then I'll have mm-hmm. to give it away. And I mean, that's the wild game waste side of things that I'm really working on, you know? So I think you and I yeah. are kind of working at two ends of the spectrum for a common good of education, you know, of
you're
focused on the perspective that you have as a background. And for that, I thank you, because we need advocacy in all areas. And something else I think is cool, and I'm a father of two grown daughters. You're focused, I think, a lot on people that don't necessarily look like the majority of hunters and fishermen, and making sure right. that they see somebody and go, Chris Abigail's doing this. I think I could do it too. I find it interesting because yeah. I want us to be a welcoming environment, right? You know, so that people want to pick this up and they don't feel like they have to look like they came from, you know, from mid Texas and be a man, right? You know?
Yeah.
And that's right. where I really respect the work that you've done is not only are you talking the talk, but you've got the chops, you know, is kind of the terminology I would use. You're demonstrating you have skill. I have seen the work that you've done on Instagram where like you had a boned out neck of a Nilgai. And for anybody that has not boned out an animal, to do the neck as well as what I saw Chris do on her Instagram picture is insane, because it's this, you know, the processes and the bones of the spine kind of go in and out, in and out, in and out, and, you know, and you just kind of laid it out there almost like a museum quality bone set. And so, you know, it's just, you know, and that's part of what I want to talk to you about today too, mm-hmm. is, you know, hopefully my audience, you know, I talk a lot about wild game cooking, and, but one of the things that's really important too is getting to the point where you have the meat in your freezer. And a big part of that is processing. And I've always said, I'm very supportive of folks taking their meat to a game processor, mm-hmm. if they would feel more comfortable doing that. But there's things they should know about prepping in the field.
Absolutely.
And I think choosing your wild game processor, because not all of them are created equal. I've had some bad experiences early mm-hmm. in my hunting career, is why I do my own now. But then I've seen others like yourself who are consummate professionals and understand kind of the needs of the hunter and the way that you do it. You're not forcing a wild game animal to be butchered like a commercial, you know, cow or pig, right. You know what I mean? Cause there's a big difference, I'm sure, that you use as well. So if we could switch gears a little bit on, mm-hmm. you know, people that, want to bring into a game processor, what are the tips, what's the approach that you would like them to have? And maybe you can use as an example some not so great moments where people have done some things too.
Well, I think that what I tell people is that there's just like two things. If you're not going to remember anything else, is to remember to keep everything cold and dry.
Yep.
Right? Cold and dry is going to be your friend in every scenario.
So so you would not say put them in any ice chest full of water for a week, you know?
No, I would say please don't do that. I'd say please don't do that. You know, there's the way that I actually prefer to get my animals is I prefer them field dressed,
yeah.
But hide on, unless you're doing something taxidermy related, because I will hang them for a few days. You know, right. That's something that we can go into, like aging venison. Yeah. Like,
will you hang them with the hide on, or do you want
it because
cleanliness?
I do hang them with the hide on.
Okay, mm-hmm. That's good.
I hang them with the hide on because you get a minimal loss.
Yeah.
You know, if you hang them hide off, you'll get the dry rind, which, yep. you know, is just fine.
Right.
But then you'll have to remove that. Unless there's getting something from the hide done for taxidermy, where I do okay. want to get the hide off as soon as possible, right. I will leave them with hide on until I'm ready to butcher. And once I'm ready to butcher, I will skin them out. Okay. And so that, for that, that maintains the meat loss sort of to the interior yeah. of the animal, you yeah. know, maybe a little bit off the hindquarters in the interior of the rib cage, but yep. otherwise everything else is well protected.
Yeah, I'm very jealous of your situation because I've seen some of the work that you've done, and you'll cut like a flank or things like that. In my practice, because I'm doing it myself, I have a lot of loss, and those thinner pieces like that, they just don't age well. You know what I mean? Like with yeah. no protection.
Right. Yeah. And that's you know, that's the downside. You know, it is. It's. And I guess that's like the difference between what a commercial processor can do and what yep. you can do in yep. your home. You know, one thing that you touched about that I agree upon is that there is definitely space, you know, for both home butchery and commercial processing. I think that commercial processors have their place. Obviously, it's what, you know, keeps me employed and happy.
Sure.
But I do believe that every hunter should know.
Yeah.
Right. Like you should know, you should have that experience. You should give yourself the gift of that labor.
Yep.
And that's really what led me to start doing a lot more education.
Yep.
Because the work, you know, a lot of times is I would hear stories from hunters being like, oh, we saved, you know, the back straps and the tenders, and then we left the rest in the woods, or, you know,
you
there's
believe
just,
that just upsets me. Upsets me so much.
Yeah. It is. It's upsetting, you know, because yeah. it's like you went through this trouble. This animal died, you know, get yeah. this, give the whole carcass a sense of purpose, right?
Right.
This,
right.
For me, my butchery, I always say that I'm honoring the hunted first and the hunter second.
I agree.
So I'm doing everything I can to ensure that the end product of this animal represents like the beauty of its life.
Yep.
And the hunter gets to then benefit and share, right? There's nobody more generous than a hunter, really.
Right.
In that sense of the word.
When you age, how long do you hang?
I would say that at a minimum 6 days.
Okay. So does it vary on animal? I mean, for instance, my perception, and I'm not as experienced as you because you get exposure to so many per year, but my perception is like an antelope, pronghorn antelope, is extremely tender and probably doesn't require as many days, whereas maybe an older, mature mule deer or something like that might take a little while. Do you see that range? Yeah. Or is that a wise tale?
I do. During off season, that gives me a little bit more flexibility in terms of when I'm aging. So that's when I'll see a lot of those. During hunting season, it's basically, it doesn't matter what animal it is. It gets a standard, six day, 7 day age.
Yeah.
And then it gets moved through the system. I think that, while aging does affect the tenderization, I think it also concentrates the flavor. So I think that every animal really benefits from an age. I don't particularly like to butcher an animal before 24 hours. 24 hours is the absolute minimum.
That's a minimum. I agree.
But a lot of times, sometimes that's not possible, right? If it's a hot day, there's nowhere to hang it. You gotta get broken down and you gotta get it put up.
Yep.
So the one thing that I tell folks is that in that instance, if you've got your animal quartered, you're not taking it to a processor, you may could consider a standing fridge or somewhere where you can age the whole quarters yourself.
I've done that actually. We kind of have a drink fridge, and my wife, thank goodness, is forgiving enough that she allows me to remove everything. And I put an entire bull elk, a 5-point, in a refrigerator. It just barely fit.
Yeah.
Now, when it got done, I did have to painstakingly clean that dude out, the refrigerator, because she's like, we are not putting the soda back in there with all that ooze. but it, like you said, it can be done, right? You can age. Yeah. That's the only way that I can really age, because I don't have a walk-in. I think there's a meme going around that if I win the lottery, you won't know it, but you'll see the signs. Well, that would be one of them, is I'd have a walk-in fridge.
Me too.
Cooler.
Me too.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, so, folks, I definitely believe it's fantastic to come to a processor. Even though I do my own, I would be happy to take it to a processor. If I'm traveling, I don't have time, or I can't get cool, because my first concern is the meat itself and to make sure that it's preserved right. And sometimes I don't have time. But, for those of us that do have time, what advice do you have? And I'll start with, because I know that you do, and I really respect these clinics that you put on at the San Antonio Food Bank. That's a really neat program. I desperately wanted to get to that one you had in February, but I couldn't make it work out. So maybe next time.
Yeah.
But how do you go about running those clinics and teaching people to be able to break down their own animal?
Oh, I'm so grateful to the San Antonio Food Bank and to Gus Avenada for allowing me to come and teach the clinics, because I'll teach at hunt camps, and I definitely like to get knives in people's hands. I carry extra knives with me.
Right.
It's like I do this all day, every day. So I want you to do it with me. But the one thing that is lacking from hunt camps is repetition.
And
repetition is really what's going to get you to hone that skill. Yeah. And so what the clinics at the food bank do is that they allow me to meet two goals where I can give people repetition, right? So we will spend, some time learning how to skin, I'll do a whole clinic where I'm the one that's breaking down the animal. We'll break for lunch. And then when we come back in the afternoon, it's like, okay, now you're going to be skinning. And now you're going to be working this part of the animal. And even if it's you get to work a shoulder and a hind quarter, I mean, you walk away with that muscle memory, right? It's really about giving people some opportunity to develop muscle memory.
Yeah.
Is the best the best way to like hone your skill, the best way to start feeling comfortable. I often tell people when they're coming to train with me for season that for it takes about a month, I think, until you start feeling comfortable without asking for my name every 5 minutes or a question, you know, like start to be able to answer your own questions.
Yeah,
I think it's a deceptively simple skill. But I also think it's less intimidating than it looks, you know? I think that once people get a knife in their hand and they start kind of navigating it, I try to get people to feel free to like fuck up and not to feel like they have to do the cuts perfect. Like it's like, forget that I've done my 10,000 hours of these cuts, right?
That's just it, is you get so much exposure and repetition. And it's like, and I've been doing this, I'm 52 and I've been doing this. I've been butchering my own deer probably for 30 years. And even I get lost sometimes. It's like every time I go to cut that hind quarter at the ball socket, I'm always like, oh, I didn't do that as well as I should have, you know, or to try to do the neck, or it's just like, damn it, I've been doing this long enough, but I do, you know, three animals maybe a year. And for you, that's a lot of big game animals, but you know, like
that
you
is get, a lot,
you know, 1,000 in a year is just crazy. And I can imagine you become really proficient, but you know, that is a fantastic clinic. How many animals do people get to work on? They get to work on like a piece or a part. Maybe they do a shoulder or a leg.
They get
a
to work. It really depends on what the food bank has available. But I would say that typically we work about 4 animals within a day.
Okay.
So, you know, for a class about 6 to 8 students. So there's a lot of, I try to make sure that everyone gets a piece to work, you know.
That's cool.
And my goal is to especially get folks to work difficult things like the neck.
Yeah.
You know, to work the muscles of the hindquarters, back straps and tenders, they take a little bit of work, but they're a little bit more accessible in terms of removing them regardless of skill level.
Yep.
But things like the neck, you know, the shoulders, stuff like that, I tried to get definitely get folks practicing on those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First of all, before we leave the food bank, can you tell folks a little bit about that food bank and the application that they have where they, I think they have a processing kind of part that's dedicated to deer, isn't it?
Yes.
Which is a really cool program that I've not seen everywhere.
Yeah. It doesn't exist really.
Right.
So, it's my understanding that the San Antonio Food Bank, they have the only on-site wild game processing site at a food bank in the country.
I think that's right.
It's called Casa Venado, and it's a beautiful facility. And what it does is that, and actually let's assume that folks don't know about Hunters for the Hungry.
Yep,
so Hunters for the Hungry is an organization nationwide where hunters can donate their kill, their take, to a processor, which in turn will process it into ground venison, send it to the food bank, and the food bank then distributes it to the community.
Right.
It's a really fantastic way for hunters to give back to the community. If you have extra tags, you don't necessarily, you know, your freezer's full, and you want to do something good for the community, it's a great way to give back.
Yep.
And so what the San Antonio Food Bank has done is that they have essentially removed the need for a lot of commercial processors. So now hunters can directly donate their hunts to the food bank. The food bank then trains volunteers to process it. It all gets turned into ground venison. There's no bespoke butchery happening, which is also great for teaching classes, you know, because then it doesn't matter.
Oh, that's right. If you mess it up, no big deal.
If you mess it up, because it's going to go into the grinder anyway.
Interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
And people listening might not fully understand, too. They might be like, well, why would somebody go shoot an animal and donate it? Well, I think in a lot of places, they have high populations of white-tailed deer, especially.
Yes.
Often there are tags issued for kind of culling from a perspective of overpopulation, especially of does. And so that may be it. Or it may be a situation where, like you're saying, the person is thoughtful and does, you know, keep their game, but they have an extra tag and they want to give back. So I think, you know, that is a good approach and it's a good outlet. And I would rather that than them put it in a freezer, store it for a year and throw it away.
That's my nightmare scenario. Well, and I think that programs like Hunters for the Hungry, programs like the San Antonio Food Bank, having Casa Venado, are really important in rewriting the narrative around hunting.
Yeah, agreed.
Right? Yeah. Where hunting is barbaric and uneducated, and the folks who are doing it just want to, like you said, you know, just looking out to kill and, you know, trophy this and trophy that and all these, and all these tropes.
Things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And all these tropes about what hunting is, you know, when in actuality, once you immerse yourself in the world, it's very welcoming. And, you know, that's one of the things that I'd like to touch upon is when we're talking about how I don't look like someone that would necessarily occupy that space that I that I do. And so I just want people to understand that in actuality, the outdoors world is very diverse and it's very open and it's very welcoming, for the express purpose that we all share the goal of preserving our wild spaces, right?
Yeah.
It's the ground is our common ground, right?
Right.
So
right.
Whatever differences that we may have, it disappears when you're out in nature, right? There's a commonality there. There's a connection there. And so folks who feel like, oh, well, you know, it's very male dominated and it's all this and it's all that, I understand, but that's just what you see on the surface,
right?
Once you actually go into the world, you'll see that there's tons of people, tons of organizations. You know, we talk about Hunters of Color. There's a bunch of women-led organizations.
Yep.
I work with The Way We Hunt that does a lot of veteran-driven, you know, female veterans. You've got a lot of women guides. You know, there's so much room.
Right.
But there's no need to feel like you don't belong. It's
the
one thing that nature does is affirm to you that that is where you belong, because we are nature, right? We are a part of it. That's the one beautiful thing about hunting that I feel that I love to see this experience in new hunters.
Yep.
When you see that they have that moment of connection to the cycle of nature.
Yeah, I feel it's very human. Right. You know, it's an experience, a human experience that I think everybody should be, if not participate in, be aware of.
Yeah.
And just, it's a bit of inclusion, you know? And so, and that sounds weird coming from a person that's kind of a majority representative, but I really do feel like people, I don't want everybody to be a hunter, but I want everybody to respect my choice to hunt, but I have a responsibility to do it in a respectful manner. And there are some on the fringe that don't do that. And I find it, you know, I think it's our responsibility to try to, you know, police is the wrong word, but to try to help them understand, you know, the implications of what they're doing and why, you know?
Yeah. I think mentorship goes a long way towards that, you know, programs like, you know, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, you know, programs like the Texas Wildlife Association.
Yeah.
There are tons of programs out there directed towards new hunters for the purpose of creating more conservation-minded, more ethically-minded hunters, which I think is fantastic in the direction that we all need to continue to go in, right? That's not everybody needs to be a hunter. Not everyone wants to be a hunter, and that's okay. You know, not everyone wants to be a gardener. You know, my husband's a gardener. I can't, you know, I don't garden, but I can hunt.
For folks that are on audio only podcasts, Chris wins the award for the best background. She's sitting in the, you may have noticed some bird sounds. those are not like that's something that I'm overlaying on this. She is sitting in the middle of a beautiful garden. There are, you know, insects buzzing by and the wind is swaying. She's got beautiful flowers behind her. So one of the best backgrounds of anybody I've ever talked to.
It's my living room.
So Chris,
we live in a tiny home and there's no room for anything in there.
But you have the outside and you have a beautiful place. I enjoy the pictures you put on Instagram.
Thank you.
So I do want to talk a little bit about, you know, kind of things that you would advise people that want to be better home butchers. Mm-hmm. And maybe we kind of walk a little bit through that. Maybe we start with kind of equipment. I think it's pretty simple, but you know, what do you think is the base set of equipment of people ought to have and how they maintain that?
Well, one thing that I talk to a lot of people about at my hunt camps is that my specific style of butchering, because that's how I've learned, is bench butchering, right? Mm-hmm. So on a table. And the experience that a lot of hunters have is doing it hanging. And so in times of when you're hanging it, you know, you're using gravity, you're using all these things that don't necessarily allow you to take the time. Right. So I would say that the first thing you do is you get yourself a table. a nice height. Got to remember about your back because you're going to be kind of bent over.
Yeah.
And some cutting boards and really a nice knife set. It doesn't have to be super expensive, custom made. You know, I've been really using Victorinox, you know, their range is, they're like $25 to $50 on the high end. Yep. And they're workhorses. Right. They're absolute workhorses. Those are the things that I would say. Mm-hmm. You know, that you really want to start out with, to set yourself up for success, you know, and then understand that it's going to take a long time, right? So don't think, okay, I'm going to go run errands in the morning and then I'm going to butcher in the afternoon. You know, I'm a professional butcher and even I'm like, okay, it's going to take me like an hour to do this animal all the way through.
Yeah.
And I have to plan for my day for that, right?
Yeah.
So I would say to block out yourself half a day at the least.
At least. And I would say that's for probably a whitetail. If you got an elk, you better have more.
Yeah, you better have a couple of days, you know, because then you're talking about the, you know, product making, not even just like the butchering of it.
Yeah.
And then you're making products. So really, one of the things that I talk a lot about when we're going to hunt camps and we're just having these conversations is how we do a lot of prep work up until the hunt.
Okay.
Right. You know, we make sure we have all our gear. I always see you like working out and prepping for your hunts, which I like always super admire. I'm like, yes.
Well, thanks.
That's the way to do it. I'm not going to do it, but he's doing it for us. You know, but like all that work that you do leading up to the hunt, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have your day of the hunt and either you're hiking out or you're doing something before the sun is up, before, you know, everybody starts waking up.
Mm-hmm.
In Texas, you're normally going out to a blind or, you know, maybe you're spot and stalk. Like there's just so much work leading up to the hunt. And then you have to hunt, right? Like... And then if you are fortunate enough and nature has allowed you to, you have an animal at your disposal, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then but then that's when the work starts. It's like all the work that you do leading up to it.
Yeah.
That's like the fun stuff,
you know?
And then the minute that animal goes down, that's when the work begins. So you have to give yourself as much, like twice as much time to do the work if you're butchering at home, then you think you need to, right? Like give yourself that gift of that time that way you don't get frustrated. You don't get discouraged.
Right.
You know, you can, look up YouTube videos. You can like find me on Instagram and feel free to like send me questions, you know,
a lot of resources,
and just to like, set yourself up for success on that way, right? Yeah. Like make yourself a plan. I make myself a plan of like when I'm going to butcher what and what I'm going to do just so that it all goes nice and smooth.
No, that was well said. I mean, just like you're saying, I mean, part of my prep is actually even, for my coolers, I don't put ice in contact with the meat. I freeze water jugs so that I can minimize, there's still some condensation, but so I can minimize the amount of water that gets in contact with meat. And so that's a process because I don't want to go buy jugs. I take, you know, gallon jugs of water, freeze them over the course of weeks, put them in a cooler, take them to where I'm hunting, and then hopefully you're successful and you put the meat in there. So just even that is a huge amount of prep, and it buys you time so that you don't have to, hurry. You have confidence. I know that meat's going to be cold, and, you cover it up. I'm saying I put a blanket or something over the cooler, keep it out of the sun, and you've got time to get it to hopefully a fridge or something where you can age it, or if 24 hours elapse, you can go ahead and start butchering.
Right.
But, so on cuts, I'm interested, something that I've seen myself do over the course of my hunting career was at first kind of like the food bank, everything was ground because I didn't really know much, steaks and some ground. And as I think I've had a journey to try to learn things to cook, I have started to leave more things whole. Like I love to have the shoulder blade and the arm roast, the blade roast and the arm roast whole. I take whole roasts out of at least one hind quarter, maybe grind some of the meat on the other. What do you find for yourself or maybe for your customers? What's the approach that you've seen that seems to be a nirvana, or is it really just kind of bespoke to the person on how they utilize it?
A little bit of both. I think that so my approach from like a commercial processor is that it's very bespoke. You know, it's very much one of my favorite things to do and is to have a discussion with a hunter and let's talk about like what you eat, especially like a newer hunter or maybe even one that's been processing for a long time and is now bringing it to me, And it's like, well, what do you like to eat? And we talk about flavor profiles and we talk about, thickness of cuts of steak or we talk about jerky. We have a whole conversation based around it because in that medium, my goal is to definitely provide the best experience, and the best product from both the animal and for the hunter. And the same goes when, we go to hunt camps and we're talking to a lot of people about home butchery. Right. And when you're talking about home butchery, I do prefer whole cuts. I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. I believe that roasts are great. One of the things that I advise folks to do is like, listen, you can slow cook a whole shoulder, right? Minimal, like good, just salt and pepper slices, slow cook it. And then you have pulled meat that you can then portion out. Right. You can portion it out.
Exactly.
And then you just have on deck like shredded meat that you can further season, however, whatever flavor profile you have. And that's one of the ways that I try to break down how intimidating it can be to do home processing, because then folks are thinking about, well, I don't have a grinder.
Right.
I don't have a stuffer. It's like, okay, what am I going to do with this animal? I have to get the whole meat off. What do I do with the meat afterwards? For me, it's like, listen, if you don't have a grinder, just throw it in the slow cooker. Slow cook it. So you have a whole deer that's like pulled meat. I mean, it's delicious. Right. It works just as well. I think, demystifying that you need a whole home butchery setup in order to be able to reap the benefits of your hunt, that's not necessarily true. And then talking about not all processors are created equal. One of the things that I would tell your audience is to ask, right? So there are two types of processing, if you're not familiar. One is called batch and one is called individual.
Okay.
And in batch processing, what they will do is that they will take your animal and they will ask you what you want. Now, if you want steak cuts, it is likely that that will come from your animal. However, if you want summer sausage or any other product, what happens is that they will butcher all animals across the board together, make product, and then divvy it out among however many hunters in that. So then you're not getting back your own venison, you know, your own wild game. You're getting a batch product of everyone's wild game.
Yeah. That's well explained and something that not everybody tells you when you go to them. You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, that's to make more informed hunters out there is to ask those questions, you know. You want someone that does individual processing and is able to sort of back that up, whether in reputation or in conversation. I think you can very quickly discern, you know, if you bring in a whitetail doe and they're like, oh, you want 50 pounds of summer sausage? Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you're not getting 50 pounds of summer sausage off a whitetail doe,
right.
You know? And so things like that will help, I think, rebuild the trust that hunters have with processors.
Yeah.
Because there is those instances where even if, like you yourself, a proficient at-home butcher, sometimes maybe you don't have the time.
Agreed.
Or you don't have the desire.
Right.
Or, you know, you have a Chris Abigail who makes great sausages.
Right.
And so you want to, like, bring her some meat. You know, so there's a space where those two things coexist.
Completely
I don't
agree.
Ever think about, you know, sometimes I'll get asked, oh, well, do you think about teaching hunters how to butcher their own? Does that, like, cut into them bringing it to you? And I said, no, I think if anything, hunters are like, oh, this is hard work.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
I might just take my next one to a processor, you know.
Yeah. Especially if you want some of those end products too, the sausages and things like that. I've kind of dabbled in it. That's not easy.
And no.
And you need better equipment. And I think I can get there, but like, like places like you work, you've got decades of experience. People, not you necessarily, but others, you know, decades of experience of doing that and doing it well. And sometimes you're like, I really don't want to sacrifice 5 years worth of bad sausage to get me there, right?
Absolutely. At 100%. You know, I have a sausage maker, you know. Mm-hmm. So think about if you're thinking about doing it all at home by yourself, understand that, like, even as a professional butcher, I have someone that makes our sausages.
Focused on just that. That's
that
crazy,
is just
man.
That is just focused on making beautiful sausage. And I can make sausage, but I cannot make sausages like hers.
Yeah.
Right? She can make sausage, but she can't butcher with my proficiency, right?
Right,
so there is that overlap.
Yeah.
And so a good sausage maker is hard to come by. And you're right that it does require years of experience. You know, we actually, me and my sausage maker, we went to sausage school last summer.
Really?
Yeah, there's a friend of mine named Bill Dumas. He runs a sausage school, and he's called the Sausage Sensei. And he will, you know, take you from production from A to Z.
Nice.
And so even if we had been making sausages for a couple of years, like going and furthering our education in that completely upped our game to now where we're like able to play with recipes a lot more.
Yep.
Where,
yep.
You know, I mean, like sausage is its own.
It is. That's
its own art form.
Good sausages.
Its own medium. Yeah, like good sausage, you know. That's the only kind of sausage we want to talk about.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
What kind of a selfish request and something I'm embarrassed to say that I do on a regular basis, but I seem to not be able to not cut myself at least once during a butchering session. And I've got a friend who used to always whisper in my ear, he'd be like, cut away, cut away. Do you have any advice for people who are prone to do things like that when they're doing their home butchering?
So I definitely I don't subscribe to the cutaway as I cut towards myself all the time.
Okay, you're making me feel
again,
better.
Again, it's like I'm self-taught. Yeah, here's what I would say. This is what I do is I should have brought a knife out. But if I've got my knife, I will put my finger on the back of the blade.
Okay.
Okay. And that's one way that I always kind of know directionally where my blade is going.
Right.
You know, so that I always have like my finger is there. It's not
that's
at the tip
idea.
Of the blade. It's just on the back of it.
Yeah.
Because if you're holding it like this,
yeah,
then you're not really feeling the pressure
Yep.
You're feeling the pressure from the back end, but if you have your finger on your knife here, you can feel the whole thing
That's good too.
where it's moving.
Yep.
So that's something that I always try to to teach in my class. If you are removing silver skin, I always tell folks to make their non-knife hand, right? So you've got your knife hand and you've got your non-knife hand. You want to take your non-knife hand and you kind of want to make a little bowl out of your top.
Yeah.
So that when you're coming through with your knife, you want your knife to be tilted up. And what this does is it keeps your fingers clear of your knife as it's coming and scraping up.
Yeah.
Right. So you don't even have to look at your knife. You can have, you know, you're removing the silver skin off the back strap.
Mm-hmm.
I can have this hand here, my knife here. I don't have to even be looking at my knife because my fingers are protected. Okay. I can just follow that line up and out.
That's a really good tip.
Yeah. So, you know, little things like that. I mean, I will still on occasion, you know, I will still occasion nick myself here and there.
Yeah.
But definitely, I will tell you that definitely in my first couple of years, you know, there was a lot of shaved knuckles.
Yeah.
You know, there's like chunks of my fingers missing.
Yeah. Yep.
It just happens. A sacrifice to the meat gods.
any advice? I would imagine you're probably a stickler on keeping your knives sharp. And so for those of us that, you know, are they're kind of not professionals at that, anything special you do in that area?
I always say that a sharp knife is a knife in use, right? So, so use your knife.
Yeah.
Practice with it. But really, I would say that the best that you can do is obviously after you wash it, don't put it away wet. That'll start dulling the blade. Make sure it's nice and dry.
Yep.
The other thing you can do is find yourself a really good guided knife sharpener.
Agreed.
You know, I use a combination of a whetstone and a diamond honing steel. If you can find yourself a diamond steel.
Yep.
Those are by far some of the best, I think. They're made by a lot of different brands. But a quality steel is always good. And then if you can get, Worksharp makes these really great sharpening devices that have guides on them. Mm-hmm. So when you're sharpening a butcher knife, you're looking for at about a 25 degree angle.
Okay.
And so one of those, the work sharps, they will often come with angle guides.
Right.
And so those angle guides are really great. I still use them.
Yeah.
You know,
it's all about consistency. You know,
it's
on that
all
every
about
stroke.
Consistency. Yeah. It's all about consistency. You want to do the same side on one knife, on one blade. You want to do it to the other side.
Yeah.
You know, you just want to take your time with it. I will sit and, you know, every once in a while, just resharpen my knives, especially before season.
Yep.
And then after season. But they don't really ever get put up. So they're always constantly in work in some way. How do I keep a knife sharp? Just keep cutting because you're going to have to keep sharpening it, you know?
It is a process.
Yeah, sure. It is a process. You know, sharpening a knife is one of those other things that it's a skill set in itself. I think it took me about 3 to 4 years, really. Mm-hmm. You know, you're starting from ground zero to feel comfortable enough to consistently be able to sharpen my knife. So,
Well, I mean, all of this is I think some of the key messages I take away from a lot of this discussion is that even a professional such as yourself, you had to start kind of at ground zero. You took time, repetition, learning from others, but not being afraid to fail and continuing to, you know, learn and grow. And, you know, I mean, you've been doing this, what, now 8, 9 years?
Yeah. I've been doing it 8 years now.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, I would encourage folks to look at your Instagram and see some of your work and be like, wow, that is really precision. I mean, if somebody, like I said, if somebody has done a pelvis, I think you've got a pelvis that you did on an animal or a neck. You know, those are some serious skills. So my compliments to you on that.
Thank you.
I want to switch gears before we run out of time and talk a little bit about your hunting experience. And I think I said at the beginning that, you know, I first was kind of introduced to you or aware of you from a BHA event that you came to and you won a rifle. And there was a bit of confusion because I'm part of the staff and I'm on the board for Texas. And somebody said, who was it that won the rifle? And somebody else said, I don't know, but there's this woman walking around with one that has this huge smile and we have to tell her that she can't take it home tonight because we have to go to an FFL, which is, you know, is the process, yeah, yeah. You know, and nobody wanted to tell you can't take it home tonight. You know,
I would have walked right out with it.
But I have rarely seen somebody so excited. You know, you were just so excited that night. And then I think it's just after that through Instagram that I became aware of you and the work that you're doing and all of that, which really kind of, you know, led to me. I think I introduced myself at the last VHA event because I was like, this person's got a cool Instagram. I need to go and say hello. So I hope you don't mind that. I probably interrupted your conversation.
No, that was fantastic.
And then as I started this podcast, I was like, you know, you're the kind of people that I want to talk to, meaning, you know, you're proficient, but also an educator of your skill. And you have a mission out there as well to help people do things Absolutely. Better in this space. I wanted to talk a little bit about your own hunting experience. So, you know, I know now you are, you've kind of started, most people start hunting and then go into butchery. You started butchery and then got mm-hmm. into hunting as a progression. And you know, I know we could go on for probably another hour about that, but where are you now in your hunting journey and your perspective on all that? I mean, I know that, you know, you kind of came to understand hunting through your butchering, but mm-hmm. to go out and do it yourself is a little bit different.
It was extremely different. It took, you know, many years. I first had to reconcile the fact that this was an animal.
Right.
Right. And then it sort of built to like, this was the hunter. And right. as I started, you know, seeing the way different animals were shot, you know, mm-hmm. It's a very intimate relationship a butcher has with, you know, especially a hunted animal.
Yeah.
It was very intimidating to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was afraid of, you know, the quote unquote bad shot, which right. I know now, right?
All of us happens. Worry about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't feel educated enough, you know, I didn't even immersed in the wild game butchery world, I had no idea how to start hunting. Hmm. I had none. Hmm. I didn't know where to go or what to do. You know, I started following sort of Instagram accounts, you know, just, but even then I didn't know. But I did know that I wanted to take that next step, that I needed to take the next step. And the one thing that I could do was in San Antonio, there is a on-site processor where you can go and choose your lamb, choose your sheep, choose your goat, and they do a halal slaughter on-site and process it for you there.
Wow. Okay.
And I did that as like a pregame hunting because I wanted to know what it felt like to right. be responsible for the death of my food.
Right.
I felt that was my next step. That was a connection that I needed. And even that was difficult.
Sure.
I think
that is even what you did was probably even more difficult than probably hunting.
Yeah, you know, but it should be, right? Like,
yeah,
I respect
agreed.
That it should be. I respect that it's bittersweet in that way. And so I had an opportunity, like maybe a few months after that, to go on my first hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened to be an Audad hunt, right? Mm-hmm. I couldn't even start out with a white tail. It was like, let's go Audad. And I went with some girlfriends of mine, you know, mm-hmm. so it was an all girls, it was all female. I felt
cool.
very empowered and sort of
right.
supported by that. They're all experienced hunters.
Mm-hmm.
We went out to Mason, Texas to a ranch run by Operation Orphans, which is an incredible organization that takes foster kids out on their
nice.
First hunt.
Very
so
cool.
I volunteer with them, you know, so like that first experience hunting was pivotal in so many ways,
right.
really in changing the course of my life. And I went out and I had that experience that I don't know I could describe. If you're a hunter and you're listening and you're watching, you know exactly what I'm talking about, right?
Yep. Yeah.
That that moment when nature wakes up and you get to be an observer, you know, and you get to just watch. And then you're in a, I always say that you're like in a place of asking, right? Yeah. If there comes a moment where you're able to get a good clean shot,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's almost, that almost feels like secondary to what is happening around you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember my, my guide, Brian, who is still a friend of mine to this day, him telling me, you know, oddads are hardy creatures.
Right.
So, you know, we have to make sure that you got to try to take the best shot you can, because she may run off in the brush. Mm-hmm. And I did a double lung hard shot.
Nice.
So she went down immediately.
Yep. That's a good feeling when you see that happen.
That was, yeah, it was, I felt such intense sadness and gratitude and like accomplishment at the same
all
time.
Wrapped
it was
together.
It was all wrapped together. It was the most intense emotional experience I think I had had in a really long time.
Yeah.
Or one, I never had one quite like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that really changed my viewpoint on where I wanted my career to go, what I wanted to do. I was like, okay, I want to, it really solidified my idea of taking my family off of like you know, grocery store meat. It was like, okay, I can do this. I can feed my family. I feel very empowered by it. And sort of, you know, just follow that path, you know?
Yeah.
And I ended up at the BAHA media, conservation conversation.
Yeah, it's a tongue twister.
Neil, I know it is a tongue twister. Just by like the generosity of my good friend, I had seen it on Instagram. And I had been, like I said, I had been looking. I was like, how do I like expand on this feeling that I had on this hunt? How do I get into this world more? This is where I want to be.
Right.
I want to have these experiences somehow. How do I get there? And so I'd seen it on Instagram and I had sent her a thing. I said, oh man, it'd be cool to go to that, but it wasn't within my budget to get the tickets. Yeah. And so she ended up getting us tickets.
Nice.
And so she's the whole reason I went, you know.
That was great. And then you came home with a rifle too.
Yeah, I went. And, you know, I went home with a rifle that I had no idea how to use. You know, it was just like, I was like, oh my God, this is great. And they're like, it's a 22. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but this is great. I will figure out what that means, you know?
Yep.
And that was, you know, I met Jesse that night and, you know, he offered me to come be at the New School of Traditional Cookery for a season.
That was the door there. Really? That
yeah,
is so
that
cool.
Was, yeah. And there I got to meet Matt Hughes and Kristen Parma of the Texas Wildlife Association. They run the Adult Learn to Hunt program.
Yeah.
And the minute I met Kristen Parma, I mean, it was like, I want to do everything else in my life with this woman all the time.
Right.
So, you know, her and Matt gave me a lot of opportunities within the Texas Wildlife Association to start.
Very cool.
Going on hunt camps. And on those hunt camps, you know, which are strictly educational camps, is really like my passion. I found it. Yep. There was, I didn't need to ever be at a hunt if I could be at a hunt camp with new hunters.
Yep.
You know, it was that same enthusiasm, that same sense of empowerment, that same like adrenaline rush that you kind of like become a junkie for. It had nothing really even to do with the kill. It's like icing if they brought something back to the processing shed.
Yeah.
But let's talk about like what your experience was like. What did you see? What did you do? What was it like? What did you hear?
Yeah.
You know, those are the parts that really sort of fueled me. And then the education aspect of it, right? Like, like I felt I had found a place where I belonged. It's like, here's something that I can contribute that will only do better for other people will only make me a better butcher. You know, I believe that, like, you want to get good at something, you teach it.
Agreed.
Right? That's how you really get good at something.
Yeah.
And, and so then from the Texas Wildlife Association, I started doing with other hunt camps. You know, I do hunt camps with The Way We Hunt. Mm-hmm. And I really love the way they run their hunt camps. Yeah, if y'all don't know them, look them up on Instagram. Yeah. They really run fantastic educational camps. And their camps tend to bring more experienced hunters like yourself, which is awesome. Because there's no bigger compliment for me to receive than for a hunter to be like, Chris Abigail, you can teach an old dog new tricks, you know? So
I wanted to come to your clinic, not because I don't know how to do it, but I was like, I guarantee there's a skill, there's something that I'm going to learn from you, because I don't know it all. And I have my own practices, but I'm self-taught, or maybe I learned from some YouTubes. And like you said, you do 1,000 animals a year. I guarantee there's things I could walk away from that clinic and go, you taught me something there, and I'm going to start using that.
Yeah, and with experienced hunters, it's fun in that way.
Yeah,
it's cool. Fun in that way, because it's then the questions become about, like, specific instances. Okay, well, I'm out in the field. How do I do this? You know, or I like yourself. You know, I love to watch your cooking podcast because your approach to cooking the wild game is great. It's so diverse, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of experienced hunters that come in and they're like, hey, you know, I've like read Hank Shaw's book, or I've been listening to this podcast, and I was really interested, you know, in neck roast and like all these different cuts that I didn't know existed on these animals, because my grandfather was just like, grind it up, boy.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And so there's this whole new wave, I think, this whole new enthusiasm in experienced hunters in wanting to up their wild game cooking skills. And so that to me is a whole other aspect that's just as exciting as working with new hunters, right?
I agree.
It's a different language, a different vocabulary, but that, like, that same reigniting of enthusiasm for hunting, for the culinary world, for conservation, it's all good.
Yeah. It's a big universe out there, and I thoroughly enjoy it, and I know you are as well. I think we could probably talk for another 2 hours, but I want to be respectful of your time. I really appreciate that you setting aside, you know, this time to talk with me, Chris.
Absolutely.
And you have a lot on your plate, so I would like if we could kind of finish up with you telling kind of what's coming up on your calendar, and also what, if people want to learn from you, you know, your Instagram, what are the opportunities, any recommendations you'd make as we work towards closing out?
Sure. So right now I'm in off season, but I'm still doing some hunt camps. I'll be going up to Jacksboro, Texas again to work with The Way We Hunt.
Nice.
I'm doing an all ladies hunt, which I think there might be still a couple of seats for, with a female ranch manager guide, Cameron Malnar. She's fantastic. And so that'll be an interesting, like, ladies hunt. It's going to be hunting in mimosas. And then also, you know, for the Texas Wildlife Association, we're starting to rev up for next year's adult Learn to Hunt camp. So Kristen Parma and I will be out in Mason at the end of June.
Great.
And so right now, you know, we're kind of in a steady gearing up for next season. I'm hoping to be teaching some more clinics at the San Antonio Food Bank. Mm-hmm. We don't have dates for that yet. You know, we'll probably get to that closer towards the end of summer. But, you know, otherwise, I always tell people, have knives, will travel, right? I'm really passionate about teaching folks. Folks can reach out on my Instagram. It's Chris_Abigail. My website is meetyourmeat.net. Feel free to, like, reach out if you have questions, or if you want to collaborate, or if you have, like, some crazy idea that you want to float past me. Mm-hmm. Come on through. I'm really passionate about sharing the knowledge. I think, like, I'm an open door in that way. I think that knowledge is meant to be given away. So,
Agreed. Agreed.
yeah.
And I would highly recommend your Instagram to anybody, even if they're not like that focused on learning butchering, because it's really your life journey. And it makes me smile every day. I'll look at your story or something. I'm like, that's funny. And I think there's some things, like I'm a bit of an introvert, and I think it looks like you are too, from a perspective of some of the things you put down there. And I'm like, I identify with what you're saying there. So I really enjoy it. And, you know, that's what Instagram ought to be, is inspiration, you know, make you smile and make connections, you know, like this. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Chris, I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I really appreciate your enthusiasm, you know, just, you know, for folks listening, you know, I reached out to Chris, you know, on Instagram, direct messages, and said, hey, would you be interested in doing this? And she said, I would love that, you know, and that's the kind of enthusiasm that I really appreciate, you know, and then, you know, was very generous with your time. It's a weekend. And you know, you could be spending this with your family or out doing things you love, and you've dedicated an hour to sit down with me and talk about the things that you love to do. So thank you so much, Chris. Thank you for your time. And I hope people seek you out and really see the talented person that you are.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris. I had such a wonderful time, and I just want to say that I'm really glad you're doing this podcast. I was really excited to see it. I follow along on your Instagram as well. I think that you are a great advocate. You're accessible. You know, you're very authentic. I think it's great for people to be able to relate to someone like you. And so you're out there. We're just out there doing the work. And I really appreciate having a peer like you out in the outdoors world.
You don't realize how much I really appreciate that. That touches my heart. And sometimes I think I'm just kind of speaking out into the void, and the only person that hears this is my mom. Because my mom and dad listen, and they keep score of who I reference, you know, because like my dad, he said, oh, you didn't talk about your mom, but you talked about me. So they're sitting at home kind of like keeping score amongst themselves of who got talked about the most. So, well, Chris, I'm going to wrap it up.
My parents will be like, you didn't talk about us at all.
But they're the origin, you know, they're the ones that gave you the foundation of where you are today. Absolutely. And had the foresight to you know, purchase the property that you have, which is beautiful. So,
yes,
Chris, we're going to wrap it up here. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend. And I can't wait for people to hear more about you and your story. So to everybody out there, thanks so much. You know, continue to focus on trying to be a better wild game cook. Go out and seek out Chris Abigail. She will teach you how to get that meat better prepared so that we can then do that wild game cooking. So thank you, everybody. Good night and good luck.
I want you to know it's over.
Bye.